How are you?
Woohoo!
Woohoo!
That's a lovely bit of reverb you've got
wicked.
There.
Yeah. Just done a whole pod of them.
Hello and welcome. This is another edition of the Odd Job Pod. I am Gary Andrews. Joining me, as ever, we have Graham Sibley and
Hello.
Terry DeFellin. Hello, gents.
Hello.
Hello, and we are, as for any bond, obviously, as listeners well know, if you listened to the last podcast, I've at least relocated to Australia, so, you know, at least keeping Bond's jet setting alive, although we know he's never been over here. But it seems appropriate when we talk about jet setting and Bond. Roger Moore is obviously one of the peak jet setters of the Bond era. And for this podcast, we thought we'd talk peak Roger. And by peak Roger, what we mean is that period where I think everybody can identify those Moore films as being, I guess, peak Roger, which were Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker. But then we're also going to discuss that transition into a slightly more pared-back version when perhaps they felt that they'd gone a little over the top. Did it work? Did it not work? You know, it's basically a glorious hour or so on Roger Moore, which, gents, I suspect you're both very much looking forward to.
Oh, I.
Oh, yeah.
So, eyebrows raised at the ready. And before we kind of go into to peak Roger and what peak Roger was, I think it's only fair to actually start off with Terry, who went quite recently to see The Spy Who Loved Me at the cinema. And I guess kind of watching a peak Roger, if you will, on the big screen, is a very different experience from watching peak Roger on the small screen.
Yeah, very much. I did see Spy Who Loved Me at the cinema the first time it came out, because I'm that old. It's actually the first James Bond film that I saw in the pictures, and I've seen everyone at the pictures since. But yes, it was a bit of a whim. I noticed that it was on at the Prince Charles Cinema, which anyone from London may well be aware of, is a independent cinema just around the back of Leicester Square, and it shows sort of like cult and cultish movies from all eras, lots and lots of genre movies, and they had Spy Who Loved Me on in their upstairs cinema at 6:10 of a Tuesday evening. Yeah. And I work in Camden, which is not very far away, and finish at 5:30 and thought, do you know what? I'm going to go and watch that movie right now. And so I sure as hell
did. The stars aligned.
Yeah, and I went in there, and it's a small cinema, but it's a massive screen, so you get the full experience. And it was mostly full of guys like me. Some were with mates and stuff like that. But, I mean, it was mostly guys, a lot of guys who clearly had the same idea there. They've just finished their shifts and they were like going, do you know what? I think I might go and watch the James Bond film right now. I could do with that. And we were all grinning like fools at the end of it when we saw it. And it was a nice clean print as well. Sometimes Prince Charles does show the original prints. Which is great, but obviously they're quite grainy and damaged by after all these years. But this was a lovely restored print, and it was just such a good film, Spy Who Loved Me. I must say that I went through a period where I kind of looked upon these Roger Moore movies as being a little bit too excessive, and preferred Bond movies that were a little bit more down to earth. But I have to say, in recent times, I've had a bit of an about face there. Largely, I think, because of my reaction to the Daniel Craig films, and how there's elements of those movies that I don't particularly enjoy. And it's made me nostalgic for earlier Bond formats that I did enjoy immensely. And I've revisited Spy Who Loved Me and welcomed it to my bosom once again. I think it's one of the best James Bond films ever, actually.
Graham, did you have you ever gone through a similar crisis of confidence over peak Roger era that Terry has?
I don't know. I mean, the Roger Moore films were the ones that I was introduced to. So these are the ones that I first saw at the cinema. Obviously, I'm the same age as Terry, so I'm of the same era. And so for me, that was all part of the cinematic experience. A lot of my cinematic memories from when I was young involve watching Roger Moore Bond films and other Roger Moore films as well.
Yes, indeed. Yeah,
because he was making other stuff as well at the time. I think there is always a lovely, comforting, sort of homing nature about a Moore Bond film. And I think that as Terry was saying, if you want to go back to something that you're very comfortable with, it's always good just to chuck on Spy Who Loved Me or even Moonraker. Now, I know Moonraker is not everyone's cup of tea, but I absolutely love that film. Mm. I remember going to see that at the cinema, and probably I've gone through the story loads of times on this podcast and on other podcasts as well about how my dad gave me the choice of going to see Moonraker with my brother or go with him to go and see Arsenal play Brighton. Because we were in Brighton for the day, and I chose Moonraker, and I don't regret my choice, even though Arsenal won 4-0.
You chose wisely.
You chose very, very wisely indeed. So obviously you've both got fond memories of peak Roger. Obviously, I being a little bit younger was actually I probably had what you might call sub peak Roger ish when, because my first experiences of Bond films. Pierce Brosnan at the movies, so it's the first time I'd kind of been to the cinema, and obviously there's elements of Brosnan that contain peak Roger for me, but I wouldn't say they're done anywhere near as well, especially when you go back and watch things like Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, which as regular listeners know is not one of my favorite films, but the more I think we've talked about it, the more I've kind of reappraised it a little bit and know that there's an awful lot to love about it. I'm still not a massive fan of the final third of the film, but up to that point, I enjoy it a lot. There is a lot to enjoy. But as I keep using the phrase peak Roger a lot, but Graham, for you, what would you say peak Roger actually is? And why would we kind of, because we chatted a little bit about this before we started recording, but why would you call this era peak Roger?
I think there's always the thing about the producers and the filmmakers of any Bond film, that whenever they bring out a new one, they've got to go bigger and better, and they've got to try and outdo themselves. And I think this is what you have with Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker. They are a peak because they're the peak of the production team's powers. And Roger is so comfortable in the role by the time he gets to this one. I mean, he's really good in Live and Let Die. Man with the Golden Gun is a rushed film. It doesn't work very well. But by the time it comes around to Spy Who Loved Me, he's so comfortable in that role, and he just makes it work for him. Mm. And it's not the most stellar of cast, actually, is it? But and I think that helps him out as well. I mean,
Yeah, it's much more his vehicle as a consequence, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, he's got some... I mean, Kurt Jurgens is a great actor, but, I mean, I think by modern standards, he might be regarded as a little bit hammy, a bit old school as a Bond villain.
Yeah.
Because wasn't there talk that it was supposed to be Spectre Adventure, and it was supposed to be perhaps that Stromberg was going to be Blofeld, perhaps? Was that...
Well,
there was all that
McCrory...
the McCrory business. Yeah.
Business going on in the background throughout the Moore era. Mm. And all the time, you know, he's that steadying ship, or like steadying hand on the tiller, isn't he, really?
Yeah.
So, and he does it so well, doesn't he?
You wouldn't
believe the amount of chaos that's going on in the background.
In the background, well, you wouldn't know exactly.
But of course, that comes to a head in after the period we're talking about, when it gets up to Octopussy, because Octopussy goes head-to-head.
Never Say Never Again.
Yeah.
And wins.
And
hands down.
Yeah. But I think that's what we mean by peak, though it's bookended by this era, when there is a transition as well. That we've got this really overblown film in Spy Who Loved Me that is completely blown out of the way by the next one that comes along, Moonraker. And then all of a sudden, we get a stripped back Bond. Well, well, we don't really get a stripped back Bond. We get a relatively stripped back Bond in For Your Eyes Only. Everyone thinks, oh, this is really pared down, but it's still got the gadgets in it.
It doesn't have the massive set piece at the end.
No.
The big battle sequences that you come to expect. We had a Moonraker and with Spy Who Loved Me. And
it looks a little lower budget, doesn't it?
It does, although, I mean, the locations in that movie are absolutely stunning. And some of the action set pieces, the car chase with the déjà vu and the ski chase, are, I mean, this is high-end stunt work, you know, and not cheap by any means. I mean, really, really good work.
Yeah. For me, it reminds me a lot of Living Daylights in certain respects.
Yeah, yeah. It has that feeling, that sense that they're trying to pare it down, but actually, in many ways, it's a very spectacular film.
Yeah.
Living Daylights is a beautifully shot film. In fact, so is For Your Eyes Only. I mean, there's areas where it is let down. We could talk about that in a second. But certainly, in tone, it is a departure from Moonraker.
And I think that's because it comes immediately after Moonraker. The differences are so apparent.
Well, it was supposed to come after Spy Who Loved Me, because when I went to the pictures, naturally I watched to the end credits, and then so James Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only, and I had forgotten, of course, that was the plan. But then Star Wars happened, I imagine, and they went, right, let's do that then.
Yeah,
Moonraker sounds good because it sounds spacey.
he's not been to Australia, but bloody hell, he's going to go to space.
Australian listeners shouldn't be offended by that, but you know, it is strange that he's been to space before Australia.
I think it's quite interesting when we talk about kind of peak of a particular era, because I know that quite often we talk a lot about Austin Powers on the pod as well, and the kind of elements that it takes in, because I think kind of what feeds into Austin Powers can quite often be an awful lot of what you might call peak Bond. Now, we know it takes a lot from Connery and especially from You Only Live Twice, but I can always see a lot of kind of that peak Roger Moore era of Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, especially feeding into that. And I think for me, if anybody asks you kind of what Roger Moore film, like what his iconic films are, these are the two that always spring out. He's done some great other ones. I think actually I prefer Octopussy to both of these two, partly because it's just such a ridiculous film, but also it's quite brilliant as well at the same point, and it's just wonderfully written and great fun. But with these films, I don't think, whether you like them or dislike them, as a Bond fan, and as I say, I kind of fall into Moonraker side of I get a bit more indifferent the longer the film goes on. You still kind of think, if the minute anybody says a Moore film, this is the type of film that you think of. You either think of Spy Who Loved Me or you think of Moonraker. And from your perspective, both you, Terry and Graham, I'm kind of wondering, is there what are those bits that just make this era of Roger Moore so iconic, other than the fact that he's clearly grown into the role and he is so comfortable and this is his kind of, this is his era. What are those iconic bits that you kind of pick out and go, this couldn't be any other era of Bond other than a peak Roger Moore era?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say to that would be just how good Roger is in these movies. I mean, how great he looks. I mean, he's at a point in his life where he looks brilliant, and he's as Graham said, as you said earlier, Graham, he's got that confidence as well of having the previous two movies before him. He now owns the role. I would have to probably look to things like the car chase in Spy Who Loved Me. I think is very, very memorable sequence. The fight in the train with Jaws, I think, is among the every good Bond needs to have a good train fight.
Yeah.
It is lamentable that Tim never got a train fight. But unfortunately, Daniel did get one in the last one. And it was a
highlight of the film, really.
Yeah. The Liparis opening up and swallowing up the submarine. And I think you'll find a lot of people who don't watch Bond movies aren't Bond fans, but only watch them when they're on ITV. Will go, oh, is this the one where they got the big boat opens up and swallows up the submarine? No, that this is the one where the spacecraft follows up the... Oh, right, yeah, that one, yeah. Moonraker, I think, perhaps less so in fairness, but as a Bond fan, I always think about the teaser, the cold open, the fight, the mid-air fight. It's just an extraordinary piece of stunt work, and And one of the reasons why people bemoan, you know, the rise of CGI is the unconvincing way that moments like this can be done with CGI, because, you know, you can't beat chucking a guy out of an aeroplane or chucking two guys out of an aeroplane and seeing what happens. It's just fantastic. So those are the moments that stick out for me.
Yeah, I would say so as well. I think as well, it's perhaps the fact that even then he was a man out of his time as well. He was this very much this sort of upper middle class, portrayed as an upper middle class toff snob going around being misogynistic.
Yeah.
And just being, even in the 70s, being almost a bit out of his time, but getting away with it because he's so suave and dashing.
And because it's ludicrous, because the situation's really... I mean, I must get with... When we were watching the film, and you know the when he goes to visit his friend in the big tent, and the line, you know, when one is in Egypt, one must delve into its treasures. And we all just laughed like schoolboys, really, really. I mean, we're all grown men, and we really ought to have known better, but who cares? We were in a cinema watching a Bond film, so, you know, it was a safe space, I think. Yeah, I mean, certainly attitudes towards women were changing rapidly in the 1970s, and not just attitudes, but laws as well. And I think that Bond existed outside of that movement, it's fair to say.
Yeah.
To put it diplomatically.
Yeah, I mean, there is the line when he gets in, when he meets Dr. Goodhead, isn't there? Which I use quite a lot. I use the little gif of it.
Can I help you?
Yes, my name is Bond. James Bond. I am looking for Dr. Goodhead.
You just found her.
A woman.
And you know, it's so it's not even 1950s, is it?
Yeah, it's outrageous. But I mean, only Roger can pull that off, and I guess to an extent it's kind of like a apologizing for your racist uncle who means well, you know. But there's sufficient humor delivered that I think that, you know, most people can kind of get past it. But no, it's not cool. And I think that is the thing about Bond, is he's not cool.
No.
And he never has been cool. No. Even back to, you know, dissing the Beatles, you know, in Goldfinger. He's not actually cool. He's not down with the kids at all.
See, it's interesting enough, you mentioned the Beatles. When I was thinking earlier what Gary was saying, why is this his peak? Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, they're his Rubber Soul and Revolver, aren't they?
Yeah. I'd say that was a fair comparison. Why not indeed?
It's a good analogy,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
when you've got those kind of films, and obviously we've talked a lot about Spy Who Loved Me, and I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head earlier when you said every film had to be just that little bit bigger and that little bit bigger. And it felt that, for me, that Moonraker, they'd obviously got a plot from the book, which they could kind of adapt and kind of go bigger as well. But, yeah, I mean, where you kind of looked at Moonraker, and I remember when I watched it when I was younger and I was still kind of sorting out where the chronology was, but I remember even very young self going, where on earth do they go from this one? Because... and almost, again, similar, I take it back because I think there's a fairly good comparison to You Only Live Twice, where you kind of, on that one, you go, right, well, they've put a supervillain's lair in a volcano. Where on earth do they go next? And where they go is something that's a bit more interesting and pared back. And again, you kind of look at Moonraker and you go, you've got a battle in space at the end of it. And actually, up until the space bit, I think it is a very sort of well entertaining Bond film. We've talked how much we love the kind of the Venice scenes in it. We've talked how much as well we love the cable car fight as well.
I love it how you're trying to control yourself, Gary, while talking about them, referring to the Venice scenes, because I mean, really, with the best will in the world, they are just nonsense. Absolute nonsense.
I love the fight in the glass factory.
The glass factory is brilliant. So that fight is brilliant.
There's so much that's just entertaining in that, and they are ridiculous. And but you, I mean, I'd, again, I'll go to Terry first on this one. But you know, do you think that obviously they went into this going, right, how do we top this kind of underwater thing? Well, space is the next logical thing. And as you say, Star Wars was out at the time. Did you kind of get a sense when you watched that going, where on earth do they go next after it?
After Moonraker? No, not at the time, yeah. No. I mean, I was a boy. I didn't care. I just loved the film and was looking forward to them doing another one. So I didn't think it through a time at all.
I must admit, 10-year-old me thought, wow, he went into space.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Basically, yeah. and also, it's worth bearing in mind that, you know, there's no story arc element to James Bond at this time. And he's only fairly recently. And indeed, you know, the ideas of genre sequels is still fairly new at this time. Star Wars is out, but Empire Strikes Back hasn't been made yet. You know, and the how our palette has changed as a consequence of Star Wars in big, high expensive, high entertainment genre fiction, and we're more tuned in to the idea of what happens next than we were back in the 1970s. And so you could just go along and you'd watch a James Bond film and that would be that. And you didn't really necessarily wonder what would happen next, apart from just assume that there would be another one because there had been for so long. But none of those movies were sequels to the previous ones. They were all there. James Bond is an anthology series.
There is a piece of the history at the start of Your Eyes Only, though.
There is, and so. It's a reference to the reference to Tracy Bond.
Yes.
There's also a reference to Tracy Bond in Spy Love Me as well.
Hmm.
So I'm not suggesting that they are, you know, entirely separate characters almost.
No. But
I mean, there's very little attention paid to the franchise's legacy.
Hmm.
They're looking forward.
One of the things I will say, though, and Graham, I wonder if you kind of think this is also kind of why this kind of ends into Pete Roger. Unusually, other than Blofeld, who's obviously had that continuity from the Connery era, you've got a character that isn't the regular ensemble who crops up again, probably due to popular demand, in Moonraker.
Yeah. You've got Jaws there, haven't you? The first villain to make a comeback.
And Jaws again feels Peak Roger.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I mean, it's such a good villain that he's too big for one film. Needs to be across two.
Scare the living daylights out of me, Jaws.
Oh yeah.
When I saw him on Spy Who Loved Me, I was genuinely frightened by him. He scared me.
The fact that he was seemingly indestructible made him all the more. I mean, he was a completely unbelievable character. Mm. But then again, you've got an unstoppable villain. How do you beat him?
Yeah.
And in the end, he doesn't beat him. He joins forces with him.
Yeah, so. It's right. I was thinking while watching Spy Love Me at the Pictures that this movie is actually very heavily informed by Jaws. The film Jaws. Because obviously it's got a character called Jaws.
Yeah.
But also it's got a heavy shark motif going on there. It's set underwater, or it's partly sort of like, and I think it's informed by the success of Jaws that was only a couple of years earlier. Jaws was 76.
Mm.
And I think that when they were making this, I think they were aware of the success of that movie and allowed that success to inform the making of Spy Who Loved Me. And of course, Moonraker, massively informed by the success of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting how Lucas and Spielberg, you know, shaping old school, you know, Iron Horse franchises that predate them already, even really, really early in their careers, just gives you an impact, an indication of just what an impact those two creators have had on movies and art, you know, throughout the decades that they were doing even then.
Yeah. It's Jaws, of course, is pretty much the only element of the book, The Spy Who Loved Me, that actually makes it to the film, doesn't it?
It's the only book I've never read.
Right.
I've never read Spy Who Loved Me. All the rest I've read.
It's a very, very different book.
Mm, I think that's probably why I have trouble reading it.
Yeah.
I've started it a few times, and then I've just put it down and never picked it back up again. So, I've got the Audible of it, I think, which is read by Rosamund Pike. So I think
actually probably a good way to consume it, actually, because it is written from a woman's perspective, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's written from an Ian Fleming's perspective of
being a woman, yeah.
Which could be interesting.
I do imagine him at his typewriter or like in drag while he was doing it.
Now I've just got pictures of Charles Grey from Diamonds Are Forever again.
Okay.
Not for the
listener. Never too far away.
More unwelcome images.
In terms of, so we sort of talk about Moonraker and we talk about Spy Who Loved Me, and we've obviously kind of, there's so many of those recurring bits. And again, we've touched on this at the kind of start of the podcast or you know, a few conversations previously, that actually For Your Eyes Only, had this come at a different time, Terry, do you think it would have been seen as slightly more of a kind of typical Bond as opposed to a paired back one? Because I was watching it the other day, and like you, I just went, well, there's some really good moments in this, and actually this is a fairly solid Bond film. It just happens to have that comparison to what went before it. Now, if this had, say, come out after The Man with the Golden Gun, I wonder whether it would have had a slightly different appraisal within the whole Bond canon.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Yeah, I think if you'd taken Spy, Love Me and Moonraker out of the franchise history, move those movies, and you go from Man with the Golden Gun straight into For Your Eyes Only, then yeah, it's not a harsh transition at all.
Do you think it's a bit of in that respect, Graham? Do you think maybe the Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, whilst also being peak Roger, do you think they're maybe a little bit of an outlier? Because actually, if you take them out and then you look and you've got Octopussy, which I think is potentially one of the closest ones to it, but even then that has a little bit more of a grounding and has a great kind of spy element to it in it. And then you kind of look at View to a Kill is obviously a fairly nonsensical film, but brilliant, but still, again, doesn't quite feel like it's of that same kind of bulk. You know, we call them peak Roger. Do you actually think that they're kind of slight outliers in terms of the Bond as a whole when you go all the way through?
Yeah, I think I think they are outliers just because they are so over the top. But you can see the direction that they're going in Man with a Golden Gun, because there's a lot of really over the top stuff in there, like the flying car.
Yeah,
let's not forget.
For example, yeah.
Yeah. And yes, the fact that he's got his island with his big ray gun and everything, and the in inverted commas comedic element of Britt Eklund.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there is a bit more of the Roger humour in Man with the Golden Gun, isn't there? It's coming through. And so, yeah, the ingredients are definitely
there. I've lost my charm.
Indeed, yeah. Not from where I'm standing. I think that Man with the Golden Gun was a disappointment. And I don't know whether or not it was a box office disappointment, but it was certainly critically a disappointment. And I think that they were right to think, well, let's maybe bring things up a notch or two, you know, and make things, maybe go back to those, because it always reminds me of, and a lot of this is Ken Adam, obviously, but it always reminds me of Your Only Live Twice, Spy Who Loved Me, because of the big set piece action at the end, the battle sequence at the end, which is, and I love a good war movie, and it's always good to see, and particularly since they use the same sound effects that from almost every other war movie that was made in the 1960s. So it's kind of got some nice callbacks there. I think that it was necessary after Moonraker for them to think, okay, well, let us literally bring things back to Earth. And do something a little bit more spy-based, a bit more Cold War-y. And I think that's why it feels like that sometimes, is because you've got the Cold War element in it, you've got the Russians there, you've got the return of General Gogol and all of that. And it just feels a little bit more, spy-ish. But, it's not without its cringeworthy moments. Obviously, the character of BB we've discussed on this podcast, but we can only discuss for a certain amount of time because, you know, we're a blokes of a certain age, and it's creepy. In fact, it's creepy even thinking about BB, and it's particularly creepy thinking about BB and Roger. That's just all manner of wrong. And of course, there's this cringeworthy scene at the very end, of course, with, what's her name? What was the name of the... She was a really...
Janet Brown.
Janet Brown, thank you.
Yeah.
Who at the time was a celebrated female impersonator.
Yes.
And her impression of Margaret Thatcher was a signature piece. And it's just awful. And it was barely standable at the time. But this movie was made before all the strife, the industrial strife happened in Margaret Thatcher's time. And so it's made with a degree of innocence that, oh, ha, 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 it's a female prime minister, let's have a bit of a laugh you know, at that. And then it transpired that Thatcher's legacy is extremely divisive, and there are people who do not and did not like her at all. And so it's left a bit of a bad taste in the mouth, I think, and it's just a terrible scene anyway, frankly.
Yes, it is.
It's badly written. It's not good. It's not even a good comedy scene. I mean,
it was meant to be another one, because they'd had the, I think he's attempting re-entry.
Yes, which was a very successful line. Yes. from Moonraker.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. There have been some shockers at the end sequence. I think the one for me that just you go and makes your skin crawl is I thought Christmas only came once a year from Pierce Brosnan, which is the most unpleasant endings and deliveries to a film.
Yeah,
at any point in there, which is
no one is enjoying that, are they? No one is enjoying that moment.
If you go back and listen to our director commentary,
yeah.
I think even the writer of that line must have had to go and take a couple of showers at least before or after.
I sincerely hope so. I'm never going to be clean again. I wouldn't want to invite the writer around to meet my mother if they thought that was a genuinely valid line. That was shocking.
Positively shocking.
Positively shocking.
But Graham, on that, I mean. With A Few Eyes Only, it's for me, I always feel it's one of the least liked Bond films. And I don't know about you, but I again, when I've kind of watched it recently, for me, I kind of, you know, you look at it and you go, actually, this is a pretty decent film. Do you think it sometimes gets a slightly hard rap for, yeah, there are problematic elements to it, but then there's problematic elements with pretty much every Bond film and every Moore film in particular. But do you kind of feel that actually as a film it's slightly hard done by, especially sort of in the whole Bond canon?
Yeah, it is a little hard done by, but I think the thing is with Fiora's Only, especially as we live in the age of box sets now, is the fact that when you're looking down through your big pile of Bond films, it's not going to be the one you're going to pick out, is it, at any time? No matter what mood you're in, you're always going to have films that you think, actually, I think I'll watch this one instead. You'll go, let's face it, there's what, 24 of them now? If you're presented with a choice, a free choice, I mean, obviously, when it's on ITV...
Exactly.
When it's on ITV4...
It's a different matter.
It's a different matter.
As then, it was the other week, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I saw it, and I thought, oh, here we go.
Here
I was only. Yeah. That'll do me.
Continues after the news. Just like old times. If you're made to sit down and watch it, but no, if circumstances offer it to you, then yeah, it's a very, very enjoyable film. But I, for me personally, you know, I can't remember really getting that DVD out too often.
No. I remember when I first got my first copy of For Your Eyes Only, I was quite excited and I watched it quite a lot, as you do with all of them. But the thing that always sticks in my mind, and I'm sure I've mentioned it before, and I'm not going to mention it again, is Bill Conti's soundtrack, which is... just at the time made me so angry, because this sort of like really weak, you know, really low rent disco kind of beat going on there, which is just really annoyed me. Now I have come to appreciate it down the years, and there's also because I'm a horrific completist, I've got the soundtrack. I own it, and there's lots of cues in that soundtrack that are really, really nice, really orchestral, really good. And Bill Conti is a fine composer. It's just that he clearly had a brief to do this this kind of more upbeat disco. He clearly going for a different tempo, and he did, that's what he did. And you know, there's times when it just really sets my teeth on edge. Interestingly, there's one cue, I can't remember which one it is, but it might be. Anyway, I don't remember which one it is, but it's almost note for note the same as a theme that he did for a 1980s TV show called The Master with Lee Van Cleef. If you put those together, then they're very, very similar tunes. Very similar. I am imagining that the he did Fury Eyes only beforehand. So yeah. So he was he wasn't afraid to regurgitate some stuff. He said, oh, I'll just lift that, put that in there. Easy money.
Mm. It's interesting with Bill Conti's soundtrack is the fact that even though it was a departure from John Barry, John Barry did Moonraker, but with Marvin Hamlisch as well, he took in contemporary themes into his soundtrack.
Yeah,
and it made it work. Yeah, and made it work really well. Yeah. It did bring Bond up into the 70s.
Yes,
not that John Barry was stuck in his ways, because he came back the next time and did a perfectly good soundtrack.
Yeah, for Octopussy. Yeah, I mean Barry was in a lot of demand at that point.
Yeah. Out of Africa,
sort of around this time, and Dances with Wolves in the same decade as well. This is peak Barry, you know, in terms of it, and he was being given gongs, and everybody wanted to employ him, and so he was having difficulty squeezing Bond in. I think he had a lot of personal loyalty to the Broccolis and to Bond to the franchise, because it made him what he was. But I mean, the Hamlisch score for Spy Who Loved Me is really, really nice, and it's a lot of fun. And as I say, the Bond 77 theme, which we've discussed on previous podcasts in loving detail as well, is particularly memorable. It's up there with the James Bond theme, and it's up there with the 007 theme.
Do you think, Graham, that perhaps you got to For Your Eyes Only because we've mentioned so many things are slightly different? They don't have a big set piece at the end. They don't. It's kind of taking it right back to the kind of Cold War era and kind of grounding it a bit more. We've obviously just talked about the Bill Conti soundtrack, which is very different from what it goes before and what goes after. Do you think that when they came to For Your Eyes Only, after that kind of peak of Moonraker and Spy Who Loved Me, do you think they just tried to change too many things to try and make it a little bit too different from what went beforehand?
Yeah, I think they did. I think it was... I wonder if For Your Only would have been a much more successful film if they'd given it to Pierce Brosnan then, or to someone else, because there was talk about it going to someone else, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah. Which would have been a shame, the idea of Moonraker being Roger's last, because, I mean, I think he had more. But
certainly.
You'll pardon the pun. I think the talk was after Octopussy, where things were getting serious, that it was time for a change, and obviously it didn't happen. But it might have worked. You're right, I think it might have worked a lot better with a younger, maybe with a younger actor.
Brosnan's wife's in it, isn't she?
Indeed. My poor Lisa. I would laugh were my heart not so heavy for my poor Lisa. Sorry. Topol is one of my favourite. I love Topol. I love Topol, and he's great in that, because it's also because he's Flash Gordon Topol as well. Milos Columbo. The character's name is Columbo, but I always say, "Oh, look, it's the one with Topol in." I love.
Yeah,
I just love. He is great. I mean, the movie's villains are a bit weak.
Julian Glover,
who is a fine actor.
Yeah, straight from his bit part in Empire Strikes Back.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes. A shield will be down in moments. You may start your landing. And he's in one of the Indiana Jones films, isn't he? He's in the third one, isn't he?
He is.
He's in the third one, yeah. But I don't think it's down to Julian Glover, but I just think that the character's a bit weak, that's all. I mean, it's got interesting, because it's got the where they're dragging, Melina and Bond are being dragged by the boat, by the boat, and across the coral reef.
Mm-hmm.
That's straight from Live and Let Die, from the book Live and Let Die. Mm. It's actually part of the climax of Fleming's Live and Let Die novel. So it's nice that they have those little Fleming kind of moments in there as well.
Isn't it?
We should do a podcast where we rank all the Roger Moore Bond villains, shouldn't we? Because
Would you say a World Cup of Bond villains?
A World Cup of Bond villains.
Ooh,
there's an idea.
Now there is an idea.
That is a great idea.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think that in summary, for Your Eyes Only, I think it's I think it gets all the criticism and praise it deserves. I think it's a pretty average James Bond outing.
I think
and
that's
it's a pretty below average movie in general. And I think that it's recognised as being that.
Would you say, just as we kind of move towards the end of this particular podcast, but were there any other Bond films or kind of specifically Moore films that you think had moments where they hit peak Roger? Now, I have one that I'll kind of lead within there, which is not much Bond in there, but Zorin's Airship, I think, is definitely up there for me with peak Roger. When you think about kind of the over-the-topness that comes from both those films, I certainly think that that's probably one element that I think could easily have been easily made it into one of those two films, and you'd have gone, yep, that fits, that's peak Roger. Are there any other peak Roger moments that you can think of from his tenure at Bond?
Well, I think very very much in the similar vein, from the same film, the fire truck chase. I mean, that's perfectly in keeping with the with the cable cars and in Moonraker, yep. Isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Completely over the top. For me, it doesn't get much more peak Roger than disarming a nuclear bomb while wearing a clown suit.
that is brilliant. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing more to say, is there, really?
Not really on that, no. I think this is probably one of the reasons as well why we all love those kind of Moore films as well, because they're not any of the other actors. Each of the actors put their own stamp on them, but that whole kind of peak element of what makes that actor, and I'm sure we could probably discuss Pete Connery, we could discuss Pete Craig, we could discuss Pete Brosnan, which we've probably done his canon to death now, but you could discuss elements of that, but I think for me that's one of the reasons why Roger Moore's Bond is so loved, because of those identifiable elements from him. I'd imagine you could both would feel the same.
Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah, certainly.
Completely. So do we feel that Roger has peaked on this podcast?
I think we've discussed all of Roger's peaks on this podcast. Well, not all of them, but it's a family podcast that we can't discuss all of Roger's peaks. I think you think that there will be listeners crying out saying that, hang on a second, you've forgotten about the "But James, I need you, so does England" as being peak Roger. There are many such peaks. Perhaps listeners will be willing to share their Roger peaks with us on the usual social outlets. Yes. That would be lovely.
Come now, Modern Bond, you enjoy killing every bit as much as I do.
Yeah, that's a film that needs to be looked at again. That scene between, I mean, Christopher Lee is such a great actor, yes. but that scene in the in the dining room with Scaramanga and Bond together, exchanging jibes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think Bond wins that showdown.
I think
as
it
well.
Does, but then you see, I mean, everyone's sort of saying about pairing it back and about getting it back to Fleming. You see Fleming's Bond right there.
Yeah,
that is Fleming's Bond.
Yeah,
and I don't think and really, you know, very very few people have actually caught the spirit of Fleming's Bond as much as Roger did in that scene,
which is ironic in a way, because I think for many people, they feel, and certainly for me for a long while. That Roger wasn't really Fleming.
No.
But actually, upon revisiting it, and you get older, your palate changes, your tastes change, you think about things differently, and you think, actually, there's a hell of a lot of Fleming in James Bond, in Roger's James Bond. And it's been wonderful, really, because it means I get to celebrate this era of the franchise so long. I was so young when I watched all of those Roger Moore films over and over and over again. And it's so nice to be able to revisit them on a slightly less superficial way. Mm. Not that I'm suggesting I'm less superficial than my teenage self. Not really. I'm recording a James Bond podcast, for Christ's sake. But you know, I'm sure you know what I mean. You know, it's just nice to look at them again. And that's why these movies endure, is because they can be rewatched. That's why people love and listen to and record
and discuss
Bond podcasts and discuss, because they can be rewatched. They're movies you can watch again and over and over again. That's why ITV keep putting them on.
Yeah,
we laugh about, oh, look, another Bond film on ITV4. If people didn't watch them, they totally wouldn't show them.
No, they put on professionals.
Iron horses, like the professionals, like the Avengers, like NCIS, you know, like the all
Sweeney.
Of these.
Yeah.
Sweeney, yeah. Iron horses, you can build a schedule around them, and that's why they're loved. And it's because they're good.
Yes, and I think that is a wonderful, it's almost like Jerry Springer's final thought there that sums us up and brings us to a point that we can all agree on in there. So, it just remains for me to say thank you to Graham and Terry. Thank you for another entertaining hour of Bond.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you very much for joining us. It's been a treat. And also, can I say, you look brilliant, because you don't realise this probably, but you're backlit. So you look like you look like Blofeld, Inspector. I mean, even now I'm expecting you to say, "Welcome, James." You look brilliant. It's a great look for you.
There appears to be a cuckoo in the nest. Yes, where I am recording, obviously this makes for brilliant audio, but where I'm recording in my house, the most convenient place for me to record has a very interesting silhouetted lighting, so it's quite hard to make out, but it's very, very suitable. It does have a wonderful spectre feel of it.
Because we can't see your face at all. It's brilliant. So menacing. I feel like I'm just about to get electrocuted in this chair.
Hello, I'm really in quite a lot of pain here.
Hello, help me. Oh, yes. No.
I won't ask at this point number one or number two. We'll leave it there on that side of things. But anyway, thank you very much, Graham and Terry. Thank you very much, listeners, as well. As Terry said, if you've got examples of peak Bond that you'd like to share with us that sit outside of either of those two films, of The Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, please do on social channels. You can find us in all the usual places. It's Odd Job Pod, Facebook, Twitter. Please do also go on to iTunes as well. If you like the podcast, do give us a rating as well, because it's always very much appreciated to know that that at least one person listens to us. Anyway, as in the best Bond fashion, the Odd Job Pod will return. Quite what? We don't know. Potentially the World Cup of Bond Villains. This could be an interesting one. We will see where we go for that. We will return in 2018, no less. Until then, have a fantastic Christmas. If you're listening to this after Christmas, hope you had a good one. And if you're listening to this just before 2018 Christmas, obviously this is starting to make absolutely no sense whatsoever. But thank you very much for your listenership. Thank you very much for your time. Please do go back, watch the three films that we've talked about, and hope you enjoy them all, even for your eyes only. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.